BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I've mentioned that my kids play youth sports. I bet yours do, too. And if you're like me, we live in the suburbs, and there's not a lot of gym space. And so, like, every other conversation I'm having is about somebody who wants to build a gym or build a baseball diamond or a football field. And these are all great ideas. I would love someone else to do that. Not me. I went down that rabbit hole once. You know, because there's a real shortage of field space. I don't care what sport your kid plays. If it's soccer or baseball or softball or volleyball or basketball, court space and field space is a thing. And so what it's caused in our household is the youngest daughter, who's in the third grade, has practice for volleyball that ends at 9 o'clock at night. And so last night, she gets home from her practice, and she's just kind of getting into the routine of, like, you need to go and, you know, you need to take a shower, you need to brush your teeth, you know, get your jammies on, do all that. And here comes some news for me, as it often does at the worst times. Some news for me is the Mountain West Conference is throwing loads of money at its members to try to keep the conference together. Gloria Navarez, the commissioner of the Mountain West, last night got her schools together and got them to agree and commit that they were going to stay together, and then formalize that agreement today. And they now have signed, all seven members have signed. What have they signed? I don't know. I don't know what kind of outs they have in that deal. I don't know if it's binding, but they've signed some kind of document that holds them together, and we'll get more into that. But, you know, I immediately start working the phones last night, and I'm like, sorry, kids, like, you know, I'm going to say goodnight to you, and I'm going to be up for a while. But what becomes clear to me in the subsequent couple of hours is that Gloria Navarez, the Mountain West Conference Commissioner, is a super competitive person. She's pissed off at the Pac-12. And the Pac-12's mad at Mountain West Conference, too. And I mentioned on yesterday's show that Teresa Gould, the Pac-12 commissioner, and Gloria Navarez, the Mountain West commissioner, they're longtime friends and coworkers, and they've known each other for decades. And I just kind of get the impression right now that they are at war in a way that is going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. The Pac-12 conference has seven members, including Utah State, the last in the door. The Mountain West Conference has seven football members, but six full-time members. They're going to need to add two to get to eight. The Mountain West Conference is using money that it believes the Pac-12 is going to pay it, and it believes that the departing schools are going to pay, to try to keep the members in place. And Navarez promising UNLV and promising Air Force, the two tentpole schools now of her conference, that they will get a larger share. And so this is fascinating stuff. Meanwhile, I'm looking at the Pac-12 and I'm trying to figure out, like, how much did they really want UNLV? How much did they really want Air Force? And we've talked about this, I think, for a better part of a week. And I'm glad football games are coming for this weekend, because I'm glad that I'm going to be able to set this down here in about 24 hours and just focus on good old-fashioned college football Saturday and, you know, Friday night football, and then Saturday, Washington playing a Friday night game. And I'm left kind of feeling like it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, right? Because there's only so many schools out there who are potential candidates for the Pac-12 or the Mountain West. Power Four schools are not leaving their Power Four conferences. And so I'm trying to figure out, how much did the Pac-12 value or covet UNLV, given that it didn't grab UNLV in that first bite of the expansion apple, so to speak, came back around for UNLV, came back around for Utah State. You've heard me talk about the viewership of the Mountain West Conference. And literally, if you look at the top viewership of the Mountain West Conference, It goes Boise State, San Diego State, Fresno State, Colorado State, Utah State. The Pac-12 took the top five. And so clearly the Pac-12 had a motivation. Now, I like Las Vegas. I like the glow of the city. It's a sports city. It's a pro sports town. People in Vegas are really feeling, I think, a little bit jilted because they thought, oh, why didn't the Pac-12 take us in that first bite? They're going to regret it. I don't think that was it. I think the Pac-12 wanted Utah State and wanted UNLV, but only at a price or a number that it could digest, meaning they weren't going to get into a bidding war with Gloria Navarez. Now, that became evident last night. I could feel the Pac-12 cooling on UNLV into the evening hours, and then was not surprised when the news came out that UNLV was prepared to stay in the Mountain West Conference. Just got the idea that we hadn't heard anything all day. It had been too long. Here came the news. But I am also kind of left thinking, like, what is the play now? What is the play for the Pac-12? And how did the Pac-12, who lived through, I think, a PR nightmare in the last 2 years, and looking like they were inept in trying to get a media rights deal and couldn't keep their schools together, and, you know, George Kliavkov, the commissioner, looking like he was bumbling around, leading presidents who were also bumbling around. And, you know, there's just a real PR misfire by the Pac-12 conferences playing itself out, and looks like it's playing itself out again. Because why? Because Pac-12 looks like it went after Memphis and Tulane and South Florida and whiffed, and then went after UNLV at Air Force and whiffed. Now, I don't even think they really offered Air Force, but they, you know, this, the appearance, in it becomes the reality, right? The perception becomes the reality for the Pac-12 conference. And the perception right now is that the Pac-12 conference is in a battle with the Mountain West, and that the Mountain West won a significant battle today in that larger war between these two conferences. I'm left feeling like the Pac-12's next move has to be a win. I find it interesting that nobody today is talking. The Pac-12 sources that I normally connect with hour to hour, all afternoon, all day long, have been very quiet today, and I think it's an intentional strategy. I think the Pac-12 is not talking, and is its next move will be, we'll get back to you when we have something to do here. But I think the move for the Pac-12 certainly is a pivot. I think it needs to go approach media companies, say, hey, look, here are our seven members. Put some escalator clauses in the deal, and then we'll go back out and we'll see if we can afford Memphis, and we'll see if we can afford Tulane, and we'll see if we can afford South Florida or whoever else is out there that you get after. In the meantime, you got a lawsuit that's going to play itself out. I am told that the Mountain West has not responded legally, but they have 30 days to respond to the Pac-12's complaint that came out, I think it was on Tuesday. And so I'm kind of left thinking, like, what are the moves? Like, Hawaii and the rest of the Mountain West off the table. Don't give me Hawaii. I don't think the Pac-12 was into Hawaii. But here's a glimpse into the other side of the equation. Memphis Athletic Director Ed Scott spoke today with reporters in Memphis because the fan base in Memphis is revolting over the idea that they didn't join the Pac-12 conference. Gary Parrish, you heard him on this show, longtime radio show host and sports columnist in that market, is banging the drum saying it was a mistake. Some fans are calling Memphis and saying, we're canceling our tickets. We're no longer supporting the university. This was a great opportunity for Memphis, and they didn't take it. But I want you to listen carefully to Ed Scott, the Memphis athletic director, as he tries to explain why Memphis didn't take the Pac-12's deal.
Is that a lot of folks, and some of you in the media, candidly, want us to go to be great, and sometimes you got to be great to go, right? And so when I hear people say, I'm not going to buy tickets, and I'm not going to support the programs, you're not really hurting me. You're hurting the student athletes, right? And you're hurting the people that are on the field playing. And that's really, really important for me. So where does this go? If y'all haven't seen the latest reports of what's going on between the Mountain West and the Pac-12, six, seven right now. This is a fluid situation, right? So that's the other thing. When we talk about the decision that was made by the University of Memphis to not join the PAC, as I like to call them right now at this time, that was not a binary decision. That was not a no, we're not ever going anywhere. That was based on the offer that was presented in front of us, that we're not taking that offer because we don't think less of ourselves. And I came here for a reason. You heard me in the press conference. You've heard me in any interview I've done. I'm bullish on Memphis's future. And so I think sometimes we get enamored by the new and we want to take a bad deal. And that deal was not a good deal for the University of Memphis. It certainly wasn't a good deal for our athletic department. And most importantly, it was a really, really bad deal for our Olympic sports.
That's Ed Scott, the Memphis AD, who is basically, I'm hearing him say right there that I'm only saying no right now. I think... The door may still be open on Memphis and Tulane and South Florida. Steven, you heard it. Don't let me put words in your mouth. What do you hear there?
I heard that the Pac-12 is lowballing once again. I don't know what this means. I think Teresa Gould, I had a lot of faith in her coming in, but I had a lot of faith in George Kliavkov, and he overrated the conference a lot as well in the media rights deal. And now I feel like Teresa Gould is doing the same thing with the Pac-12 name. If they're not going to give a good enough deal to get Memphis in there, what are they going to do? I just feel like right now they have swung and missed in so many different things, John. And maybe I am just, you know, still thinking about the past and pessimistic from the past. You know,
well, of course, those scars of the past, I think, are absolutely playing a role. But that's part of your PR, and that's part of the job of the Pac-12 to change that narrative.
But when I hear Memphis say the deal wasn't good enough, it makes me think, okay, the Pac-12 is overrating themselves again, and they're going to be left out again because they think that they should just get all these schools for the deal that they want. Sometimes you have to, negotiate and get that deal and get a deal done and maybe give up a little more. Gloria Navarez, the Mountain West, John, she's given UNLV and Air Force, what, $25 million to stay in their conference? That's over what they're worth, but she got it, and she's giving them that money because she wants to build the conference. The Pac-12 is not giving in to anybody, and I love the fact that they think they're so great because I love the Pac-12, but maybe you're overrating yourself just a little bit, and you need to give in a little bit.
I hear Ed Scott saying that the offer that was made, which was the first offer, wasn't good, and they're waiting maybe to hear another offer. I also know that, you know, look, Gloria Navarez, where'd she get the money, Steven? She got the money from the Pac-12. She got the money from, she doesn't actually have the money. The money is the exit fees of the five departing members who are paying $17 million each. And she's just saying, hey, I will pass that through to you, UNLV, and to you, Air Force, and to every other member. We're going to split this up. Because we're gonna hold this conference together. I don't want to be George Kliavkov.
But if Memphis has already come out and committed to the American, even if they get another offer, can they really go back on all those commitments that they've
100%,
made?
100%.
Do you think that? I mean, yes. That's terrible PR for them, isn't it?
Yeah, but it happened. That Pac-12 schools did that all day long during the negotiation in the last 2 years.
But they didn't, like, tweet things out, like, put their school with that conference.
They did. Go back and look at the Pac-12's Twitter feed after USC and UCLA left. We're committed. We're bonded together. We're taking a vow of, it was basically this big show of solidarity almost 2 years. And then right up until the point where, you know, it was like, hey, Oregon and Washington are leaving, and then there goes Arizona running for the hills. So there goes ASU and
Utah. Is it different, though, that it would be like a week apart? Like Memphis literally like last week just said, yeah, we're staying. Or was it earlier this week? I can't. They're all run together.
It was earlier. It was Monday. Monday at noon.
It's not 2 years like it was for the Pac-12. Like, it is literally going to be week of. Like, they're going to change their minds and just put out a whole bunch of new. I don't know. I don't see that. I think it's my scars coming back at the Pac-12. Like, they're just overrating themselves.
Don't blame you. I think there is a lot of bad PR that is out there that the Pac-12 is mismanaged, and they played a role in it. I also think, like, look, the exit fees for the American Athletic Conference, it's about $25 million per school. It's pricey. The Pac-12, we are told, offered about $2.5 million. We'll help you with 10% of that. So when I hear Ed Scott saying the offer wasn't a good offer for us, he's just doing the math. And, you know, the accountants in the athletic department are going, look, hey, we're on the hook for 90% of $25 million. The media rights deal is better, but we don't make it up in 5 years. This is not a good deal for us. I think the Pac-12 in that initial offer. Now, I don't make an offer unless I know they're taking it. So I think the Pac-12 was foolish to get those terms out there to the three schools and then look like their offer wasn't good enough. But secondarily, it seems to me, but between Memphis, Tulane, South Florida, UNLV, the acts of the last 4 days. It seems to me that the Pac-12 likes these schools but doesn't love these schools. And I keep wondering, you know, what is it that they really want? Because if you have something that you really want, Gloria Navarez really wants to keep Air Force and UNLV. It's all she's got, right? She's got to throw everything she has to keep them. Tim Pernetti, the commissioner of the AAC, he has Memphis, Tulane, South Florida. Those are his best schools, most valuable schools. That's why he's on the ground in Memphis playing defense the minute he thinks the Pac-12's after him. The Pac-12 has made kind of a half-hearted effort at Memphis, Tulane, and South Florida. And then, you know, I heard they were going to match anything that the Mountain West Conference offered, and apparently they did not when it came to UNLV. And I'm left thinking, like, is it possible that if they wanted UNLV, they really would have grabbed him with the first bite? And they came back and got Utah State because the numbers were right. And what was Utah State doing? Utah State was packed. They had their bags out. They were on the curb. They were waiting in front of the house. They were ready to go. And UNLV was not. And so I kind of just wonder if Boise State, Fresno State, San Diego State, Colorado State had seen enough of UNLV and Air Force and were like, no, we want something else. And so I'm wondering what that something else is. Is it possible that the Pac-12 is going to grab Gonzaga and Grand Canyon and try to build a basketball conference and then grab a football-only member like UConn and say, hey, we'll play those four or five football games against UConn every year, and everything else, we're just going to become a great basketball conference? It's possible that's the move. It's possible that they could come out of this looking great. But what I need the Pac-12 to do right now is to stop talking and stop making offers that aren't going to get accepted and take control of the narrative that they are in control of this and not constantly playing defense or constantly asking and wishing and hoping because it looks bad right now. Now, yesterday, we had a big story break about the UNLV quarterback who quit the team, essentially, even though they're undefeated, even though they're ranked, even though, like, here's this great season. You got the UNLV quarterback saying, hey, I didn't get my money. I'm leaving. Next segment, I went out and I found the foremost expert that can talk about this. Debbie Spander is a sports agent. She has founded a sports agency. She teaches a class at USC about NIL and very outspoken about what athletes should be getting, how the sports entities and the colleges should be acting. The founder and CEO of Insight Sports, who represents media, coaches, front office people, and athletes in the NIL space, teacher at USC, professor at USC, Debbie Spander coming up next. I want you to hear from her because we're going to dive into where is this headed, what needs to happen, all of sort of the nuances of NIL and what comes next, coming up next with Debbie Spander. Leave it here.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, for years you've heard Art Spander come on this show. This guy's been to like every Rose Bowl in history, every Masters in history, such a legend as a sports writer. We've brought him on over the years. Excited to bring his kid on the show, Debbie Spander, joining us, founder and CEO of Insight Sports, representing sports media and coaches and teaching the NIL experience at USC. Debbie Spander joining us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, John. And always good to be Art Spander's kid.
I know. I led with that.
even after all these years.
Can I ask you before we get into all the NIL stuff? Like, I have three daughters. What was that like to grow up with a dad who's a sports writer?
It was awesome. He started taking us to events, or my mom physically would take us to events he was covering when we were little. I mean, I remember running around Oakland Coliseum at Warriors games when I was like 3-4 years old. So it was just part of growing up. And if we wanted to see our dad, we had to go to the game to say hi at halftime. So I always really liked it and loved going to all the events I got taken to, like Final Fours and Super Bowls. And then I wrote for the Stanford Daily and decided to go to law school.
and then here you are back into sports. I mean, I think it's probably not accidental, is it?
No, it's not. I actually went to law school to have that background to get into the business side of sports.
Let's talk a little business. The story breaks yesterday, UNLV's quarterback, you know, verbal agreement, dispute over NIL funds. What were your immediate takeaways as a lawyer, as an agent, as a sports person? You know, how did you kind of view this initially, or maybe take us through your thinking as you look at this situation?
I mean, we're just in this really weird state now. So my thinking was not surprising. I'm sure there are others out there. You know, marketing NIL is legal thanks to Alston. NIL stands for name, image, and likeness, which is like your right of publicity. Because of the Alston case, the NCAA is allowing athletes to enter into agreements for their right of publicity, marketing deals, appearance deals, card deals, charity deals, but not be paid for going to the school. However, now you've got these collectives representing the schools, or not representing the schools, as the case may be, and promising athletes X amount of money to come to the school, but actually, since there's no pay for play, they're being paid for these marketing rights. So it's all convoluted, and of course, there's no written agreement, so it's tough to enforce it. But even some of these written agreements are tough to enforce because it's not really what it is. Is that confusing?
No, it isn't. And I think part of it is, I wonder how much the athletes understand state to state, you know, who can negotiate what can be in writing. You know, you teach a course at USC on the NIL experience, and when you get students in that class, I have to think, you know, you get various levels of understanding as it pertains to NIL, but do you just dive into the basics on day one and walk through everything, or how do you approach teaching athletes and students about NIL?
Well, I mean, what's the most interesting is literally it changes week to week. I mean, the area is evolving so rapidly, and now, of course, we're all waiting to see if there's going to be a house settlement or not going to be a house settlement, if there's going to be some $20 million plus pot of money that athletic departments will be able to distribute between athletes as they see fit, of course, or if the non-Power 4 conferences are not going to sign on to it. And actually, Judge Claudia Wilkin isn't very happy with some of the language in it. And then we're back to square one, and we're still litigating all of this. So, I mean, the most interesting thing about NIL is that it literally changes all the time. But do try to kind of teach where it came from. And the very first thing, I teach it with my husband, Mark Eisenberg. The very first thing we teach is that the word student athlete was coined by the NCAA to keep athletes in perpetual amateurism. The very first athletic event in the 1880s was a regatta up in Maine between, I believe it was Harvard and Yale or Princeton or something, and it was sponsored by the railroad companies and hotels to get people to vacation up there. So, I mean, since day one, there's been money paid to the NCAA and schools while the athletes have been excluded in the names of amateurism.
A lot of people will like to say, well, we need guardrails. You know, the NCAA needs guardrails. What's your response to that when people say, you know, this is why we need guardrails?
Well, we can have guardrails when it is actually acknowledged that the athletes should be collectively bargaining for their share of the revenues, and they have representation to do so, whether it's individual lawyers or agents or, you know, kind of what I foresee happening if we do ever get to that stage is that maybe one of the existing players associations, the NFLPA or the NBPA, who are very great at negotiating collective bargaining agreements, will create a division to help college athletes as well.
We're talking to Debbie.
Go ahead. I say, until we get to that point, what kind of guardrails are they? Because we're living in kind of a false reality where there is no pay for play. I'm using quote marks in the air, but there really is collective.
Give me an idea. If You know, if, Debbie, if I said to you, "Hey, you know what? You're going to be the czar here. You're going to figure out. You're going to help us figure out a system that protects players and also maybe gets it a little under control, so we don't have people in the middle of the season feeling like they got a bad deal and they're leaving a school, or you don't have coaches who feel like this is ongoing. What kinds of things do we need to be thinking about?"
Well, I think that the house settlement as proposed for the athlete side would actually be terrific, because it would, it's still being negotiated, but somewhere between $20 and $24 million a year would be paid by the athletic departments to the athletes they determine should be paid. Now, of course, that's a little bit of an issue, but then you're kind of getting the collectives, which aren't part of the university, out of the middle, and everything is enforceable. On the other side, I'd say it would be terrific if when entering into something like this, or whether it's just a flat revenue share deal from the monies coming in from media deals, ticket sales, sponsorships, that there is, you know, some collective bargaining agreement on behalf of the players. The other, you know, the other thing that's going on are the NLRB cases, where they're taking it up to the National Labor Relations Board. So we got a lot of lawsuits and cases going on in this area right now, but we're still kind of in a gray area.
Debbie Spender is with us, the founder and CEO of Insight Sports. It teaches a class called the NIL Experience at USC as well. Let me ask you, you know, specifically with the case involving the UNLV quarterback, I'm looking at Matthew Sluka's agent and going, why wasn't something in writing? Is it wrong for me to kind of go, hey, look, this is lesson one for every other athlete out there. Don't take a promise. Make sure that you have representation. Make sure you have something in writing.
Well, I mean, he had representation. The question is, you know, what type of agent did he sign with? I don't know anything about this agent, but number one, yes, you want everything in writing. You want a written agreement between yourself and the collective, or the marketing company, or the charity, whatever is putting up the money, or else it's likely unenforceable. You know, a big problem is there's no standards for NIL agents, whereas a NFL agent, an NBA agent, MLB agent, they all have to be licensed by the unions and take exams. Anybody can hold themselves out as an NIL agent, and, you know, it's a little dicey out there. There's hundreds, if not thousands of people saying I'm an NIL agent, and, you know, at some point, until there is a collective bargaining unit, you know, maybe you need to get a lawyer involved.
Yeah, I noticed that with some of the college players that I cover suddenly had people representing them, and I started to kind of go, well, who are these people? And I think part of the issue, maybe, you know, you can speak to this, is initially there wasn't enough money in it to get, like, the right long-term established agents involved, and it seemed to be, you know, it was an agent who had represented a UFC fighter, or an agent who, you know, was kind of on the fringes of things. But it seems like now it's becoming a little more mainstream. Are you seeing that change?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of the big sports agencies have NIL divisions. Wasserman, Clutch, CAA, WME, Excel, they all do have those divisions. And there are agencies who just do NIL who are also very reputable, but there's a, you know, kind of an in-between area as well.
Debbie, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and that's where parents need to get involved and help their children. I mean, you can't even legally sign a contract until you're 18. It's cancelable or unenforceable. So if you're, I mean, Matthew transferred, so he's obviously over 18, but if, you know, you're 17 and a senior in high school, we need help with this.
I'm thinking that, you know, fans are frustrated too, and fans are going, I hear a lot of people saying, hey, I'm all for players earning money, but shouldn't, you know, part of that collective bargaining be that if you sign an NIL deal, you have to stay at a school? What would you expect to be involved in a fair and honest discussion, or a fair and honest collective bargaining session between players and the universities or the NCAA, whoever's on the other side of that table these days, what kinds of parameters or points would be important to both sides?
Absolutely. I think, getting rid of all of the transfer windows, not all of them, but some of them, there's a lot of transfer windows right now. And, this may sound a little bit like an employment contract, but yes, you sign your letter of intent to attend a school, and you're going to get X amount of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and there can be a term on it as well. There's, nothing illegal about signing a two-year agreement or three-year agreement and agreeing not to transfer.
I like that. I like that, and I do like to see players develop and grow, and what I fear is we've got unrestricted free agency, and it feels like, even the last 24 hours, we've got, okay, couple of players basically saying, hey, you know what, I'm going to sit. And
yep.
I get it. We're watching athletes that are figuring out how much power and how much influence they have and trying to figure it out. I really appreciate you joining us, and I guess before I let you go, I'd love for you to talk to us about maybe what you think the biggest misconception is in the public that would be important to speak to.
I mean, I think the biggest misconception is likely that if there is some sort of pay for play, that college sports as we know it is going to be over. That the money has been there for years, whether it was bags of cash or 20s or 100s handed by by boosters to players as they ran off the field, or FedExes of cash. And right now it's become the collective's pain. So the money has always been there. It's just if it's being distributed above board or below board. So I actually think college sports will be better if everything is negotiated and above board, and then we don't kind of need to worry about the gray area. College football, college basketball, volleyball, whatever you love, will still be competitive and fun to watch.
I love that. I appreciate your time. Appreciate what you're doing out there. Say hi to your dad for us. I know our listeners for years loved his stories. Did he tell those stories? Would he sit around the table and tell those stories, or was he only telling us those stories?
Sometimes. I think he told you guys and like his buddies in the press room more, but I'm actually trying to record some of them now. A friend of mine and I are doing kind of a video series recording some of these stories because they're priceless.
I got a treat for you because I probably had him on maybe 10 times, and they always went long. Those interviews always went long. You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly.
And so I will send you the podcast links for those so you can
amazing.
You can always have those, okay?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
All right. Wish you the best. I'm probably going to pick your brain at another point when more of this stuff comes up. But thank you, Debbie Spander.
Absolutely.
Appreciate you. Okay. Take care.
Very welcome, John. You're welcome.
There she goes. Steven, it's professional sports. We all know it. The schools can say they're student athletes. They can try all they want to say student athlete this, that. The athletes are in control. And I don't think they're going to cede control of college sports until the colleges come to the table and say, okay, we're going to give you employment contracts. We're going to give you, the ability to transfer in certain periods of time. In exchange, what we need is you only get to transfer during one portal window, one time a year. And if you sign one of these deals, they are binding employment contracts that leave you, tied to your university. You can't leave after four games. But I still will go back. Look, UNLV looks bad here. UNLV looks like they don't have any money. I guess they do today. Use some of that Pac-12 money. But UNLV doesn't look like they have any money. Doesn't look like the coaching staff and has it together. Did the assistant coach make a promise? Did the head coach make a promise? I've heard from so many people who have opinions on this. But I go back. My immediate thought was, well, this is an education. If somebody promises you something, get it in writing. Get it in writing. We wouldn't be here today. But I kind of wonder, I'm not even going to blame the kid. I kind of wonder who this agent was who's representing him. But off the rails, Stephen, what do you make of that conversation with Debbie Spander?
Yeah, it is fascinating because I think we can all agree, and even me, I've always been a proponent of college athletics is different than the pros, but I've never been like saying they shouldn't get paid or they shouldn't get compensated for it. It should just be in a different way. And now it is turning into, and our the guests made this perfectly clear, like they're going to go and get their money that they deserve. And now she says, this is the part that I worry about, John. She says, don't worry about it. She said, don't worry about it. Once this all gets done, it's out in the open. We're going to love college sports again. It's going to be great again. I don't know that I buy that because I think it's going to turn into more of a professional level. In the year 2030, are we looking at if football breaks off by itself, are they affiliated with the schools? Like, I think that's what always brings me to what makes college sports great is that it's the alumni, it's the schools, it's the rivalries. I don't want it to be a AAA football league. If it's just the Oregon Ducks, not the University of Oregon Ducks, is it different? I think it is. And so that goes back to like the Pac-12 and how I want them to get Gonzaga and St. Mary's and Grand Canyon, because I don't know that college basketball breaks off from the affiliation of sport of the school. So it just worry. I don't know. The whole thing just makes me worry that college football is going to break off and is going to be its own professional league, and it's going to be about the play on the field, which is not what it's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about everything else, which makes it great.
I just don't want it to be the NFL, and I love the differences. People have always asked me what is my favorite thing to watch or what is my favorite thing to cover. It's college football for me, and then it might be college basketball after that, and I really like the NFL, but there's just a certain business feel to the NFL that removes some of the charm, and we've watched in the last year as some of that charm has left the college game. So I still am hopeful that the youthful feel of college athletics won't be lost and replaced by everybody sort of being, I got to get what's mine, and this is a professional setting, and I'm a pro. And, part of the charm, too, as a media member interviewing college kids is, like, they're different interviews than NFL and professional players because they aren't as tuned into kind of their corporate, like Jaden Robinson's coming on later in the show, and I get the impression I'm talking to like a college senior. I don't feel like I'm talking to a guy who's in his sixth year in the NFL who isn't going to really say anything or tell us what he really thinks because he's afraid it's going to hurt, a potential endorsement interview if he says the right wrong thing. And I don't want the game to lose that. And then the other part is I don't like all the movement. I hate it. I liked when we could watch a young player come into a program, play a little bit, and then we could go, ooh, that guy's going to be really good in 2 years. Let's see what he blossoms into. And we've lost that now because there's so much movement. We're not really getting to watch and appreciate like what Aiden Childs has become. And we're not getting to see sort of a player blossom you got to go, okay, where did that guy end up? Where is he playing now? I do hope like some of what Debbie Spander was talking about with, the contracts and things like that could maybe help alleviate that a little bit. But I also don't want to be naive because, look, this is we're in a capitalist society and the market for a college quarterback or a linebacker or a running back is what it is. And the market doesn't lie. And I don't want to stand in the way of another person who is entitled to go earn what the market commands them. I'm not going to begrudge that person for following, that their dream or following, what their brain and their advisors and their parents tell them what to do. I mean, that's no different than, like yelling at high school kids who choose a different school because they think it's a better fit for them. I mean, so I'm interested to see a little more structure here. And I'm also interested in how that might benefit not just the schools and not just the athletes, but the game itself. Big Splash coming up.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
So the Mountain West Conference has released statements, including the distribution percentages for the members who are staying in their conference. They've got 7 football members, 6 full-time members. They're going to need to go after 2 schools. I'm looking at University of Texas, El Paso, and Texas State. Keep an eye on those 2 Texas schools in the Mountain West. Pac-12 may be after them as well, or the Pac-12 may be after Gonzaga, Grand Canyon, and some other combination. The Pac-12 only needs 1 school, ideally, or minimally, to have the minimum of 8 schools and be considered a conference. But I'm not mad at the Mountain West for correcting the percentages. I'm glad they corrected them. People make mistakes. I've made worse mistakes than that.
I got a question for you. What do you make of the reports out there about Sacramento State willing to help build their stadium and renovate it to try to get into the Pac-12?
I like that they have some vision. And you know, I got tipped off to the fact that they were doing the stadium thing a few weeks ago, and I had a email exchange with Ann Cudd, the president at Portland State, about it, because it's similar to the kind of vision I would like to see Portland State have. You know, long term, I don't know. Short term, I love it because it's an FCS school saying, hey, we want to be so much more. We want to be something bigger. And stadium's not huge, but it scales kind of like Snapdragon Stadium in San Diego State. And it's in a metropolitan area that can definitely support recruiting. And I think they're probably looking over at San Jose State going, we can do better than that. And so I like it. I like that they're trying to do something, but it's a big leap from that lower division up to FBS. It, you know, used to be Division I AA up to Division I. Now, you know, FCS schools trying to become FBS schools. The fee, though, to move up is $5 million for your school. And you don't have, because the playoff revenue distributions have already been decided for the next 7 years, you get no playoff money for 7 years. So it's going to require not just a stadium. It's going to require private equity or some conference that really wants you to believe in it. And, you know, I just think it's very interesting. I just got a note from a source saying that there may be something cooking on the Pac-12 front. So I don't know if you heard the little beep there, but it distracted me a little bit mid-thought. By the way, the Pac-12, I think, has a strategy. I think they don't want to just be bigger for the sake of being bigger. They don't want to just add anyone. I don't think Air Force was ever important to them, was probably as important to them as Hawaii was. Like, Air Force, I think, made a sneaky good deal here, getting 24.5% of the money from the Mountain West while not really being coveted by the Pac-12, probably more of an American target than anything, the American Athletic Conference. But and UNLV is about the 6th best school in the Mountain West right now. And so I think the Pac-12 got what it wanted pretty much out of the Mountain West, and I think it's looking elsewhere. So, you know, I will try to find something out on the commercial break. I may have some news on that front when we come back after the break here at the top of the hour. But Sacramento State, I mean, look, it's going to cost you a lot of money to move up, but I like it. They look like they're going to take a swing, Stephen. Like, you know, I wish Portland State would do this. I wish that Portland State had vision like this and had a plan like this. And, you know, Portland State right now needs an athletic director, and maybe it needs to find somebody who has this kind of vision.
They also need a stadium first.
Yes.
That'd be the problem.
I would, but gosh, I don't know. When I saw South Waterfront Ballpark, I went, gosh, could Portland State play football games in there? You know, like, it's not like it's being used that time of year, Stephen.
No, that's a great point. I mean, it would be such a good thing. And, I mean, at this point, you know, with conference realignment, we have no idea what's going to happen. Like, there's so many schools that are taking swings, you know, and nobody knows the right answer. Like, if you're Memphis, is it the right move to stay in the American, or should they have taken a worse dealing on the Pac-12? We
no,
just don't,
you don't
know.
You don't move to just a move, though, right? You can't. Like, I get what the Memphis AD is saying.
But was it the right move for UNLV and Air Force to stay? I mean, I don't know. Probably not, but they're getting a bunch of cash.
I think you make the decision that you do not move and do not leave your conference unless a no-brainer offer is placed in front of you. And I think when Gloria Navarez, the Mountain West commissioner, to her credit, throws all this money at her schools, like, that's her way of solving this problem. You know, I had another college administrator say, there's no blueprint for this. You're making this up as you go. All right, Punch and Audio is coming up. I'm going to try to see if there's some news here. Stick around.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I think Monday's show was pretty nutty, wasn't it? We may get a little bit of news on the Pac-12 front. I don't want to oversell, but I'm being told something might be cooking right now by somebody that I trust. So we'll keep you apprised of that. Thankfully, somebody on Twitter did the math for me. The percentages for the Mountain West came out, and Air Force getting 24.5%. And UNLV getting 24.5% based on the exit fees. Let's just use exit fees because the poaching penalties, you don't know. Are they going away? The attorneys for the Pac-12 think so. Based on the exit fees only, it would be about $20.8 million for UNLV and Air Force. $9.7 million for all the schools not named UNLV and Air Force. Except for Hawaii. Hawaii getting $4.25 million. And before you say Hawaii needs a better AD, just know Craig Angelos, the AD at Hawaii, is a good guy. Competent guy. Hawaii's just a football-only member. So Hawaii gets less for that reason. Hawaii's in a really hard spot. It's a great place to visit. Steven, you like going to Hawaii?
You know, that is one place I've never been. I've never been to Hawaii.
We need to get the folks at All About and the Hawaii Visitors Bureau to send us back over there. We used to do shows from there and go do countdowns to Hawaii. BFT listeners may remember, oh, it's going to be 30 days. Canzano's going to be in Hawaii. The All About people who are great. And also... the Visitors Bureau used to, make it a point. Now, part of the deal of going to Hawaii, Stephen, is you have to do, if you go on like kind of a promotional tour, you have to do all the things like zip lining and you have to do luau and you got to do all kind of the, tourist activities. I'm more of a, let me get somewhere and sit on the beach guy, but I did it because they were like, you got to go swim with the sharks. In a shark tank. Would you do all that stuff?
I mean, if I had to, yeah. But I mean, ideally, I'm a guy that wants to get there and just do nothing. Like, yes. That's what I like to do on vacations. But there's two different type of people in this world. People that vacation and want to do all the activities. And there's people like me who wants to get there and go on vacation and do nothing. Like, even when I go to Vegas, John, it's not like we're going out and partying and doing all these crazy things. It's like we're sitting by the pool. I'm going to the sports book. We're just hanging out. It's not a lot. Like, we're going to eat a nice meal. Not a lot of like crazy stuff we're doing, and that's what I would do in Hawaii. But I mean, if I had to do it, you know, if you're yanking me and I have to do this and then we're going to Hawaii for free, I guess I'll do all the
The shark tank? Would you go swim with sharks in the middle of the ocean?
If I had to, I would hate every second of it though.
I did. I did it and I didn't like it.
I would be absolutely frightened.
I actually like the luau's. Like, some people don't like to do the luau's because they can be a little touristy. But I kinda like that. I'm there, I'm a tourist. Like, and my thing is, if I'm doing something all day on the beach, I don't mind sitting around eating some pork watching the show of the luau. I don't mind going a little touristy later. And look, I was like probably 30 years old before I went to Hawaii for the first time. And it was because one of the schools I was covering was playing a football game at Hawaii. And I went over and I was like, this is pretty nice. I get to come over and spend a couple days in Hawaii. This is great. Andy Katz, who the great basketball reporter, and I went over for a basketball tournament in Hawaii. And I had a great experience sitting at like a buffet with Jerry Tarkanian, just listening to him tell stories. Like, that was a nice Hawaii trip for me. But I digress. We need to get you to Hawaii, man.
I agree. Yeah, let's get your boy over to Hawaii ASAP.
But the problem with Hawaii, this is where I was going, it's great to visit. It, you know, wonderful place probably to live. Like, Hawaiian people, fist bump, shout out. You know, they seem to have a connection with, you know, the land and nature that I think a lot of us lack here. But it's not an ideal place to travel to if you are flying like 90 people and a bunch of football equipment, you know, over the ocean for 4 or 5 hours. And so there are real costs that these football teams have to absorb in trying to play over there. And guess what? The old Aloha Stadium crumbling, and they're talking about knocking it down and building a new stadium. They don't have a stadium, and so they're playing on their own campus with temporary stands put up. It looks like, all due respect, it looks like a community college setup, and it's not a good look. And I wonder, I kind of worry if Hawaii will continue to play football when the dust settles on expansion. That you just see, like, even in this payout that the Mountain West is doing for all their members, you know, UNLV and Air Force getting 24.5% of whatever they get, whatever they're using percentages because they don't know what they're going to get. And UNLV getting 5%, or excuse me, Hawaii getting 5%. It just shows you kind of where they are in that world. So we shall see. I'll try to get to the bottom of whatever the Pac-12 has cooking. I'm told whatever it is not done, but the Pac-12 is working on something. I have two different sources telling me that the conference is now huddled up working on something. So you may get to hear it in real time on this show. Just listen for the ding of my phone as I'm receiving messages over here. And I normally don't have that on during the show, but I don't want to miss something.
I'll make sure not to message you, though, because I don't want to, like, confuse the fans.
No.
They hear a ding, and it's just like me, you know, sending you some joke or something.
Well, you know what's interesting? The sources no longer want to text, because I think they worry that text messages are, you know, get caught in discovery. They want to use other apps. So, you know, it's got kind of a stealth cloak-like feel to some of this communication that I'm not totally comfortable with. But that's how they want to communicate. That's where they feel a little freer to share.
The world is evolving, John. College football world is evolving. Phone technology evolving.
So, giddy up, as they say. Looks like something might be coming down the pipeline, Stephen. So, Pac-12 not sitting on its laurels. And it can't afford to sit, right? If you're the Pac-12, Mountain West just got its act together. And fist bump to Gloria Navarez, commissioner there. Pac-12's got to answer this. Like, they're in competition now for some of the same schools. So we'll see what the Pac-12's move is. In the meantime, a little bit of sadness. Can we talk about the sadness in Oakland? The A's playing the last game at the Oakland Coliseum. I got a text message today from a friend of mine who said he got sentimental, and he didn't know. He's not an A's fan. I'm not an A's fan, but I grew up in the Bay Area, and I feel bad for A's fans. Let's listen here as the Oakland A's television broadcast summed it up.
Looks like we have a bit of an issue out here in right field. Looks like a smoke bomb.
This is going to stop play for a minute.
When you can hear the fans booing. And I think something that I've taken away from the interaction with the fans leading up to today is, no doubt, there's still some individuals who are angry, understandably. But I think the overwhelming sentiment was we are here to enjoy this. We are here to celebrate this.
A's fans are mad. They have been abused by ownership in the Fisher family. They have had their NFL team leave for Vegas. They've had their NBA team leave for San Francisco, essentially. And now the A's playing their last home game at the Coliseum. Mark Kotze, the manager of the A's, had to address the crowd.
There are no better fans than you guys. Thank you all for loving the game of baseball. Thank you for your lifelong support of the Oakland A's. And last, I want to thank you guys for coming out today to share this moment with the club that I'm so proud of. We've played our asses off this year. We still got three left, gentlemen.
There's the manager of the Oakland A's talking to the crowd.
Here's a wild stat for you, John. 2004, that was the last season before John Fisher took over as ownership of the team. The payroll is $59.4 million. This season, 20 years later, the payroll $62.7 million. Just $3 million more in 20 years since John Fisher took over.
That's classic. It's so cheap, and it's such the blueprint for you know, a franchise that wants to get out and get somewhere else. And, you know, I just think it's just so disappointing to see what has happened to that franchise. Now, look, I grew up a Giants fan. I was not an A's fan. I rooted against the A's in the Bay Bridge Series 1989. And I really do believe the Giants would have won that World Series had there not been an earthquake. Giants were worried about people. A's were just playing baseball, played right through it. That's my stake. That's my story, at least. But A's also had really good hitters and good pitching. But the Coliseum, it was always, as a kid who grew up in the Bay Area, it was, you know, the A's belonged to the East Bay. That was their team. And that's, you know, there was a whole swath of people in the San Francisco Bay Area who rooted for that team and loved that team. And I have a memory of being about 5 or 6 or 7 years old and going to the Coliseum with my parents. And I can remember that we sat on the first base side. I can remember we were up high. We weren't like really close to the field. And I just remember being at the ballpark. It might be my earliest memory of being at a Major League Baseball ballpark. And I might have been like 5, 6 years old. And that would have been in the heyday of the Oakland A's as they were playing really good baseball. Now, the Giants were my team. Candlestick Park was my place. And much like my friend who texted me today, who said, man, I got a little wispy. I also got wispy, and I just feel really bad for the fans in Oakland. Steven, think about what they've lost with the Raiders leaving, the Warriors going across the bay. People will be like, oh, the Raiders going to Vegas, and the Warriors going across the bay. And people will say, oh, the Warriors are still, you know, the Golden State Warriors. But for anybody who knows the Bay Area, when you cross that bridge and you go into San Francisco with your team, you might as well be a million miles away from Oakland. And you're not going to get the same fans who rooted for the Warriors crossing that bridge and going, I'm going to follow my team into downtown, you know, into San Francisco and go root for them. It's a Grand Canyon. It's, you know, and I have seen the fan base and been in that arena. It has changed. It's not Oakland's team, and the Raiders are not Oakland's team. The A's are all that those fans had left, and it's a crying shame that the A's are on the move. And I'm actually, like, today was a reminder, like, I'm kind of glad that Portland didn't end up being the city that stole the A's from Oakland, because I don't think it would feel very good today.
I kind of agree with you, too, because I'm not an A's fan. Like, you know, just being on the West Coast, I always kind of, you know, the A's are okay. Like, I never had a problem with them. I always thought their atmospheres were really fun. Like, when they made the playoffs, they had a couple of those runs, and, I mean, those fans were brilliant, and that place was rocking. And you think of all the memorable plays that happened there, the Derek Jeter flip, you know, those type of things. It would feel weird. It would feel weird if Portland was the place that took that team, because it was emotional today. There was a lot of fans. There was tears everywhere. That clip you played, they had to stop play because a smoke bomb was thrown on the field. That wasn't the only time that happened. There were some beer bottles thrown on the field as well during the game. Like, these fans deserved better from all reports. And you have, you know, guys like Jeff Pass and Buster Olney talking about how bad of an owner John Fisher was and how he wanted them out of there. And you just... you feel bad for that team, because I think about that as a Blazer fan. Like, I grew up in Portland. I've always been a Blazer fan. And there's always, like, the rumor of, oh, the Blazers can move to Seattle. The Blazers can move. Like, that would break my heart if that happened. And, you know, I have a weird relationship with the Blazers as I worked for them, and they let me go. So I kind of, you know, lost, like, the love of it. But I will always have love in my heart for the Blazers. And I feel for all those fans in Oakland today.
I also think, too, like, you know, for me, I feel sad for those fans. But I think those fans are way past the sadness. They, you know, when they're throwing things onto the field and they're chanting things, those fans are angry, you know. And that stadium was not great, okay? It wasn't a great stadium. I covered games there when I was back, you know, covering baseball. I covered, you know, playoff game, MLB playoff games in 2000 and 2001 there. It was the Moneyball A's playing against the Twins, I think, that the year that you know, Billy Beane was doing Moneyball, and I covered that series as a journalist. And, you know, the stadium wasn't great. It wasn't a great football stadium. It needed help. It needed work. But I think the A's fans have gone from being sad to being angry to being bitter about what happened to them. And part of the thing is, I don't think they're getting... You won't be able to reverse this. You won't be able to get them back. But it's a reminder, I think, to every, like, you hit on it as a Blazer fan, you can relate, because it's a reminder of what these franchises mean to their cities, to kids who grow up in a city, and to kids who, you know, go have a memory of going to a ballpark. These sports cathedrals and these stadium experiences, you know, we can talk about TV, we often do, but you can't replace what's happening at the stadium. And let's go to the phone lines real quick here. Dre in Portland has called in. Dre, go ahead.
Jay, definitely, definitely sad day, man. I didn't think it would hit me like this. I knew it was going to happen, right? But I just happened to turn the TV on, and as I'm watching the game, it brings it all back, man. That was the A's. That was the first time I saw a professional baseball game, and my mom took me. Yeah. Right, I was a Giants fan in the family. Everybody else were A's fans, but it brings it back. It brings back my childhood when our All Star team from Alameda, when we made All Stars, we went to the A's game. Everybody took their glove. I mean, it's just my father in law who passed away. Excuse me, my stepdad who passed away. Big A's fan. Like, it brings all that back, man. Take Bart to the game, like. All of that time will definitely be missed, man. The A's, that whole era, it will be missed, man. And I'm glad you touched on it and gave me a chance to talk about it, Jake.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate you. Steven, go ahead. You had some thoughts as well.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, because when the Raiders moved to Vegas, there was a lot of fans, I feel like, that still stayed fans of the Raiders. I can't imagine that the A's fans are going to be fans of the Las Vegas Athletics when they move.
No.
Like, but it just seems different. But also at the same time, like, a lot of those football fans remained fans of the Raiders. But the Athletics are not going to be fans of Las Vegas A's.
And I don't think Sonics fans did not become Thunder fans. You know, it's you know, and if your team left and packed up in the middle of the night, left for, you know, Baltimore, you didn't become a Ravens fan. You know, you were mad, and so maybe Rams fans are different, because, I don't know, were people in L.A. that transient that they went, hey, the Rams go to St. Louis, they come back, could still be a Rams fan all the way through it? I don't know, I'd have to hear from a Rams fan. But I just think once a team leaves, it dies, and I don't know how people in Oakland replace that. And, you know, we talk all the time on this show about what the Blazers mean to a lot of people who grew up here, and what the Ducks and the Beavers mean, and what having a WNBA team will mean to young girls in the market who may grow up and get to see basketball games that feature professional athletes. And now yesterday we're talking with Jed Lowry about a Major League Baseball ballpark on the South Waterfront. And, you know, I would just encourage people as they kind of absorb this to think about, you know, we always talk intangibles in sports. Well, there are some intangible things that happen when you've got a sports stadium in your life as a young person in a sports franchise. Jaden Robinson, Oregon State defensive back, coming up next. Leave it here. Hey.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
What is that ballpark in your life? Like, if we talk about the Oakland Coliseum today and people lamenting that place being their place, if Candlestick Park, may it rest in peace, is my place, I'd like to know what stadium, sports venue, place that you've been, doesn't have to be the place you've been the most, but what place speaks to you in that way that maybe the Oakland Coliseum speaks? And, you know, I remember Dwight Clark, the former 49er, talking about Candlestick Park. He said it was a dump, but at least it was our dump. And I related to that as a kid. It was freezing cold. The winds would whip around. It was not the easiest place to go watch a baseball game. Made more for football in a lot of ways. But, damn it, that was my place. What's yours? 503-417-7575. We'll take your phone calls. Jaden Robinson will be joining us coming up. He will be talking with us about the upcoming off week for Oregon State, and it's an interview that is brought to you by Jamba. Life is better blended. Shout out to the people at Jamba who every week sponsor that segment. So Jaden Robinson coming up. But tell me that place. What stadium is that stadium or venue or NBA arena or college arena, or it could even be a park. You could call in and tell me, hey, it was a park in my old neighborhood, and here's the park. Tell me what made it great. Tell me that place that speaks to you in that way. If people are getting wispy in Oakland today about the Oakland Coliseum's last baseball game and the lights being turned out and how lousy it is that the A's are leaving, that's part of the loss. But, you know, for me, it is also part of the loss that that venue is going to sit empty. And I know, not just as a media member that covered Raiders games and covered A's games and drove by, you know, was on 880 freeway, I-880 in Oakland, and would exit and go see, like, to the Oakland Coliseum there and the and see games there and cover games there. Like, it wasn't just the team, it was the venue itself. And I want to know, what's that place that speaks to you in that way? And only you can answer this. There are no wrong answers here. At 503-417-7575. If you're listening at Fox Sports Eugene, I want to hear from you. If you're listening in Klamath Falls on 960 AM, I want to hear from you. If you're in Southern Oregon on the Ace, I want to hear from you. I want to hear from you if you're in Bend listening to the show. Get a lot of emails from listeners in Bend who are hanging out in the good sunshine, and tell me what that stadium or that place was for you. Now, Stephen, is it safe to say that it's the Rose Garden Arena or Motor Center for you?
No, it's not the Rose Garden. It's the Coliseum. Okay. It's the Memorial Coliseum.
Oh, okay.
It's also, there's two of them for me. It's the Memorial Coliseum because as a kid, just watching those games, like, I went in there maybe a couple years ago with my kids watching some, like, monster truck show. And it's still the same on the inside. And, like, I can see and I can picture all the highlight tapes that I watch. I remember watching, like, the season review tapes, you know, the Bill Shonley is narrated as a kid. And I can see it in my mind when I'm watching the Monster Truck Show. I can see the, you know, the outside of the seats and how it all looked and how Kersey was on the fast break and Drexler was on the fast break. And it's not, like, a great building. Like, it looks cool on the outside, the glass palace, but it's not, like, super nice. But it just, it brings back a lot of memories. Made me really love basketball and love the Blazers. The other one is Randall Hall at Clackamas Community College. that's where I really developed. I mean, I spent hours upon hours just refining my game and becoming a really good basketball player. And, you know, that has brought me so much in life to be able to play basketball in college and get my school paid for. Yeah. And my whole career, like anytime I go back in there, just it brings back a lot of good memories. So Randall Hall and the Memorial Coliseum for me.
There you go. Well, I want to know yours. 503-417-7575. Let's go to Dave, who is in Vancouver. Dave, what's that place for you?
Well, I wasn't going to talk about that, but you mentioned the Oakland Alameda stadium. So it was about a year or 2 years after the earthquake. Me and a buddy took a trip to Frisco. We did Candlestick. And then the next day, the A's were out of town all weekend. But the next day, we just went to like get a picture of the stadium.
Yeah.
And one of the gates was just open. And so we just walked in. We said, well, they can just tell us to leave. And we saw one guy, and he was out just watering the outfield with the hose. And I'm in the dugout. I'm on the phone that goes to the bullpen. We took so many pictures. I'm on the pitcher's mound. It was awesome. And that was before digital crap. So it's all on film. But it was a cool memory. And a buddy actually brought that up about a week ago, and I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, I had a similar experience in Boston with Fenway Park. I was there to cover a Blazers game years and years ago, and all I remember in that game was Kevin Garnett played in that game for Boston, and I was there, and it was an off day before the Blazers game, and I was like, oh, I want to go see Fenway. And Stephen, when I went by Fenway, the gates were open, and I walked into Fenway, and they were redoing the grass in the sod, and, you know, it was all kind of torn up. But I kind of walked in, and nobody said anything. And I was just, like, looking around Fenway. And it was a pretty cool experience. Garth is called in. He's in Elk Grove, California. Garth, what's up, man?
Hey, John. I've been reading your stuff, and I learned about you because my parents live in Sisters.
Awesome. But, thank them for me.
Yeah, I pretty much grew up an A's fan. I became a fan of the A's when Ricky was a rookie. Yeah. And I actually lived in Alaska at the time, and then we moved to the Bay Area because my dad's in the military. And I became a huge A's fan because we lived in Walnut Creek, and I was a young teen, and I could hop on BART. All I needed to do is have my mom drop me off, and I'd take BART all the way to the Coliseum, and I listened to Bill King and Lon Simmons, and so that was the era when they were kind of getting towards the tail end of Billy Ball. And I just, even though, like it's kind of like what Dwight Clark said, it was our dump. I mean, even then it wasn't that great.
Right.
And it wasn't anywhere near as old as it is now.
I know.
I love the A's, but the only solace that I take is that I get to actually see them here because I live in the Sacramento area, and I'm going to go to the field here and watch them play in Sacramento.
Will the fans in Sacramento go bananas for this? I mean, will they, you know, Rivercats fans, I'm sure, support that team, but Major League Baseball there, will they go nuts for it?
I think that they will. I think that it's going to be sellouts for the entire season. You have to realize that the size of the field here is nothing like a major league size. You know, one of my recommendations would have been go above all the equipment areas that they have in left field where there's no seats at about 5,000-6,000 seats. That way you get up to 20,000. Because right now they can probably hold, if they jam people in there, about 15,000 people. They're going to sell place out for all 81 games.
Yeah. Really cool. Hey, one more thing before you go. You're in Elk Grove, and Sacramento State announcing today that they've got a big vision for a stadium, and you know they want to matter, maybe play up to the FBS division. How did that go over with people in Sacramento?
You know, I think people in Sacramento are pretty excited about it because college football here has gotten bigger and bigger. The Causeway Classic, which is between UC Davis and Sac State every year, it's kind of like a Civil War type thing for the FCS schools here. It's become a pretty big deal in the last probably 15, 20 years, and Sacramento State has been really one of the top teams in the FCS, and they're really going all out to really try to upgrade their program. And I actually know the brother of the president of Sac State, and he's doing all the right moves to try to get Sac State to be a bigger program and get them into the FCS level because that's their goal.
It's good to hear people are excited. I appreciate you, Garth, and Elk Grove, and say hi to your parents and sisters listening on the ticket. Chris is in Sherwood. Chris, welcome.
How you doing, John?
I'm well.
Good.
What's your place?
Grew up in San Jose, lifetime A's fan since 1978.
All right.
I've been waiting around since the 90s when Cisco Systems had a ballpark designed for the Athletics out in Fremont and Alameda County. And then Alameda County and Fremont both said, no, we don't want you. I'm excited about them going to Vegas. I'm looking forward to actually getting back and going to games. My wife and I will be taking our girls and flying down there in a couple of years to go see games.
What are your memories of, like, the late 70s, early 80s being in that stadium?
Well, I loved Ricky Henderson, so every time I got to go to a game or watch it on TV. But I think my first memory of going to the Coliseum and watching a game, Dave Kingman was still playing for him. And I watched him hit a line drive home run out over the wall and into the parking lot. And I think I was 5. And at 5 years old, I realized how amazing that was. And then my memories of watching McGuire just, crank homer after homer and watching Ricky Henderson steal bases there. And all those great players of the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. Smell the grass, a hot dog, having beer spilt on me by some fan behind me.
Yeah. Look, I'm glad you're going to Vegas. It's good to hear somebody who's saying, I am connected still, even though my fandom has been disconnected by bad ownership. Mike is in Seattle. Mike has a question for me. What's up, Mike?
Hey, John, how are you? So I'm
all right.
Intrigued by professional journalists like yourself.
Okay.
And how do you go harvest these sources? And why do the sources want to give you the information? Is there an ulterior motive to their approach? Or is it like I've got a secret and I got to tell somebody, but I don't want people to know who I am?
Some of both, I would answer just quickly. I think I'm going to leave you on here in case you have a follow-up. But some of it is some of these people don't want to talk to me. Let's start with that one, okay? Some of the people don't want to talk to me. I talked to somebody in the Big 12 conference today who did not want to talk to me. But I knew that Oregon State Women's Gymnastics has been approved by the Big 12 presidents to be an affiliate member. And I didn't want to report it without at least calling the Big 12 conference and saying, hey, I know that your presidents have approved this. Your ADs have to rubber stamp it. The Big 12 doesn't want it out there. I don't want to be wrong here, but, if I report this, am I going to be wrong about it? And then, and they say, no, you're not. I really, really don't want to talk to you. But they, as a professional courtesy, they will confirm things. And part of the job is networking and I think being a little bit personable and talking with people and sharing information sometimes, because sometimes these people are calling me and going, like right now, if I'm looking at my phone right now, I have a conference commissioner in another conference asking me what's going on. I have an AD at a school that is in the West Coast Conference asking me, exchanging texts with me. I've got, a PR person and, or two in there at the top. There's a lot of exchanging of information going back and forth because I think that there are some curious people out there. And then when you call on them later, they trust you and they feel like they can share with you. But some of it, too, might be what you said, like they've got a secret and they want to be the one to share it. There is a little bit of human nature in it, of course. And then let's get to your other point. You're right. You have to ask yourself, anytime somebody gives me information, I got to ask myself why they're giving it to me.
Why? Why? Five whys.
Why are you giving this to me? What are you trying to accomplish by getting this out there? Or, and I do think there's cases where some of these people they'll burn you, if you're not careful, and they'll give you information that's not accurate. And so
I always will make the extra call after I get the information just to make sure I can cross-verify it. And generally as a courtesy, yeah.
Yeah, do these athletic departments, do they view the press, you know, like you, as a tool to help them, you know, with their fan base? I mean, I'm trying to figure out the why, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm an athletic director at a Pac-12 school, old Pac-12 school, I don't know why I'd want you to get anything out for me when I can get it out myself now. But they want to keep the relationship going with you because mm-hmm. they need you at times, and sometimes they don't need you, right?
So or they don't want to make an enemy out of you. They don't want to lie to you by making it. You know. So they go, I'm not going to lie to you. I had that come up with one AD who misled me. And I then subsequently just started, you know, going, I can't trust this person. I have to verify everything this person says to me. And right. they very quickly will figure out, like, they don't want to be in that relationship with you because then, you know, there are times where it does benefit them to have information out there. And then here's some other ones. Like, you know, there are some, let's just use the Big 12 gymnastics thing because it's so innocent as an example. Like, there are some people in the Big 12 who really do want it out there that, hey, some Oregon State high-profile gymnasts are going to be competing in the Big 12. That's kind of exciting. And that's coming up in, you know, not this season, but next season, like 2 seasons from now. And so they want that out there, but they're not cleared to you know, say that information publicly. And if they do say that information publicly, they get called out by their university or their peers or, you know, their colleagues right. as, you know, hey, why are you putting that out? We weren't ready to officially do that yet. But, you know, everyone's kind of looking at each other going, what's the reason we're not putting this out there?
Well, and so I'm intrigued too because, you know, when you say, I mean, these department employees, they can't use their state issued device.
Right.
So they must be using other things, which are probably in violation of some of their code of conduct stuff. So
maybe
kind of a slippery slope. So it's really interesting. And it's getting to the point where you really can't tell who knows what and when and how. I mean, I trust you. You know, when you say right. it, then it's been corroborated. But everybody else, they think they're journalists, and they're not. They're entertainers. Right. So good right. job. I keep listening in Seattle.
Thank you, man. Here's another thing that happens. You know, like, it's John Wilner and I were talking about this today, okay? I had some information. Wilner had the same information. And Ross Dellinger of Yahoo Sports had the same information. And we all kind of tweeted it at the same time the other day. And Wilner and I were comparing notes going, okay, how did that go down in your space? And it turned out that the person who was planning that information, you know, obviously wanted it out there and kind of planted it in 3 different places all at the same time. So those things happen. All right. I want more of your phone calls, your stadiums, your ballparks, the places you go, the places you've been. What speaks to you as a sports fan?
503-417-7575. You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I love that question from Mike in Seattle last segment. And I'll say this, too, on when it comes to, like, developing sources. You know, sometimes it's as simple as talking to the graduate assistant coach or the usher or the low-level assistant or the student manager who rises to become an athletic director someday. And you just sort of develop a friendship and a connection. And, you know, hey, it's more of a professional friendship, but I can tell you this, too. Like, I don't think the Pac-12 was helped by me reporting that there were offers on the table from Memphis and Tulane and South Florida. I don't think they were happy that that got out there in the way that it did. I don't think they were happy that I reported that UNLV had an offer from the Pac-12, even though it got out in other ways. They wouldn't have wanted me to report that. And I don't think the Mountain West was happy that I reported that part of their plan
was to try to divide. They at least had discussed trying to divide Oregon State and Washington State and trying to poach Washington State into their conference. And so I think sometimes your motivation or goal as a reporter, and my motivation and goal is I work for you. I work for my readers at johnconzano.com. I work for you because you listen to the show. I serve you. Like, I am here to put sunshine and find out things and then not just break news if I can, or, you know, sometimes it's okay if someone else breaks news. I don't need to be first all the time. I want to be right. But the second part of it is I want to be here to tell you what it means or what I think of it or help you understand it when stuff does happen. So I think that often is maybe in some ways more important. Let's go to the phone lines. I want to hear about your ballparks and your stadiums. The A's fans are a little wispy today, and I think understandably so, about their last home baseball game. 417-7575 in the 503 area code. That's the phone number. Eric is in Vancouver. Eric, what is up?
Hey, I got a unique one for you. My nostalgic place is Candlestick Park, like you, but for a different reason. I was actually born in the Bay Area, Santa Clara, but my dad, who was born in L.A., and was living there when the Dodgers moved there, made sure that I would never, ever be a Giants fan. So we moved up to Portland when I was a kid, but we, you know, had family connections in the Bay, and so we'd go back frequently. And my nostalgic memories are going to Dodger-Giants games at Candlestick Park, being in the, you know, the heat of the moment, being like 7 years old, 10 years old, and drunk Giant fans, you know, hammering me with curse words and everything. Jeez. And looking around and seeing fights and brawls. Yeah. And seeing fights and brawls in the crowd and being like, wow, this is baseball, you know.
Did you wear your Dodger stuff to Candlestick?
Oh, yeah. Like, man, I remember, like, being out in the, you know how you, to leave Candlestick Park.
Yeah.
You had to, you know, it was going to be a major traffic jam unless you got out of there quickly.
Terrible.
And I remember running to the parking lot as soon as the last out happened with my dad running, and then being cursed at by Giant fans and everything like that. And I was like, I'm 7 years old. What are you doing, man? You know? But I got to tell you, like, so that's my nostalgic moment. I really remember those and cherish those. But I got to say, if a baseball team comes to Portland, it would be an absolute dream come true. And I just get goosebumps at the very thought of maybe taking my son now and my elderly dad, who would be in his probably mid-80s by the time that it happens.
Yes.
And I just know that I would, like, cry and kiss those grounds if that stadium's ever built. And I really hope that my son can have those moments the same as I had with my dad. I think that those are some of the most cherished dreams. And I'm actually talking to my dad about taking him to when the Ducks go to play at Iowa next year. We're going to go to Field of Dreams at the same time.
And, oh, I love it.
And try to have a catch there and everything. But anyway.
Have a catch with your dad.
Thank you so much for the topic. Yeah.
Love that. Yeah, appreciate that. See that he gets it. Norm is in Portland. Norm, you tell me, what's the stadium for you?
I've actually got a couple. The main one is the old King Dome. That's where I saw my first football game, my very first professional baseball game. Got a chance to see Nolan Ryan pitch in his last year. It may have been his last game because he left the game early with an arm injury, and I don't know if he pitched the rest of that season, but definitely the King Dome. And my other one isn't a professional park. It's actually one that was used, if anybody played youth baseball in the west side, the old Alpenrose Dairy.
Oh, yeah. Yep. You're not going to be alone there. And my oldest remembers going on an Easter egg hunt at Alpenrose. Love that. Brad's in Eugene. Brad, welcome. What's your stadium?
Well, so I grew up in the D.C. area, and of course RFK was my hallowed ground for the NFL franchise at the time. But I used to be a Baltimore Orioles fan. I would road trip up to Baltimore and went to a lot of games in Old Memorial Stadium, and that place was an absolute dump. And then when Camden Yards came around and it was the first new school, all the amenities, smaller scale, just it was really, really cool to watch the resurgence of the team and the the Cal Ripken era, and just it was just really special. So Camden Yards, just as the first of the new stadiums, really just holds a special place in my heart.
Yeah, the Giants, as they moved to downtown San Francisco, I was so envious of the Giants fans because Candlestick was my park, and those Giants fans had a beautiful brick stadium and McCovey Cove and all that, but I never really got to enjoy that as a fan. Chris is in Wilsonville. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, John. I grew up in Oakland, California. Went to the A's first game in 1968. Got to go to a World Series game in 72, 3, and 4.
Wow.
And, of course, went to a number of Raider games over the years as a kid, and it's a pretty empty day.
Yeah. Yep, I think you summarize it. Yucky day, empty day, a lot of emotion. Let's go to Eugene. I believe it is Paul. Paul, what's up, man?
Hey, John. I'm a longtime Oregon resident at this point in my life, but I was born and raised in Detroit, and I was a Detroit firefighter, and back in the day, Detroit police and fire could get into ball games free.
Ooh.
There was a section in the bottom of, in the lower grandstands of Wright Field.
Love
and so
that.
My dad would come home from his off days as a fireman. He always delivered beer, and he would take one of my brothers or me. I've got great memories of opening day in 1986, the Red Sox versus the Tigers, and Kirk Gibson single-handedly willed the Tigers to victory.
Oh, I love it.
And all of these great memories and nostalgia of mine are also, there's some horror to it as well.
All right, we're going
to
run out of time. I'm so sorry, Paul and Eugene, we're going to run out of time. We got the 5 at 5 coming up. Great stories.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I know I'm going to mess this up because I'm not a military person, but I have a friend whose son flies these high-level F-16, F-14, I don't know what it is. Don't at me, okay? But he's basically in the Air Force. And he flies one of these jets. Is that what we call them? That goes faster than anything in the sky. And his job is to keep our country safe. I'm only bringing this up because we were talking about stadiums. But did you know that military personnel at, it might be all the ballparks, but certainly it's a lot of the ballparks, get in free or get in at a highly reduced rate, particularly if they're active duty. Okay? So, my friend's son, and I'm going to have to get the details on this to get it right, but I'm going to give you the general gist of the story, has certain hours that he has to be in the air and flying these things around the country. They do patrols. They get them up in the air. You know, they don't have all these planes down on the ground. They get them up in the air. They get them moving around. They're, you know, it's part of their day. You know, their Monday through Friday is that thing's got to be up in the air. You have to fly a certain number of hours, you know, and they have shifts and whatnot. All right. So my friend's son is also a baseball fan. And so he and his fellow pilots hatched an idea that they decided they were going to try to see how many Major League Baseball games they could get to in a single day. Their goal was to watch 3 outs. And I want to say that they got to 6 or 8 different Major League Baseball parks and saw an inning. The goal might have been 9. Maybe they were trying to get a 9-inning game in, but in 9 different ballparks. But I think they got to like 6 or 8 of them. And what they would do is like they mapped it out on a day where Major League Baseball had a bunch of games being played. And they were flying mostly in the Pacific time zone, Mountain time zone, Central time planes. And I don't have a sense of how fast these things travel, but they made it sound like the trip between like Seattle and San Francisco was like 25 minutes, you know, in one of these jets. I don't know. I'd have to know how fast they're flying and what the distance is. But they mapped it out in a way where they could fly, land, take a taxi, go to the ballpark, watch three outs, take a taxi back, get back in the jet, fly to the next place, park, you know, set it down. And they did this all day long. And, you know, my friend's son would be mad, you know, me retelling the story. But, Steven, I think they saw like 6 or 8 innings of Major League Baseball while they were on duty. And just trying to be like, how fast can we get between the Arizona Diamondbacks ballpark and San Francisco? And phew, there they went, you know? I'm probably not doing it justice, the sound of that, you know, that deal as it goes by. But I don't know. Like, I've tried to retell the story, and if I get it wrong, please forgive me. Like, F-14, F-16, I don't know. It's one of those things that goes really fast. And for people who know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. Yes. That was better, was it not? All right, Steven, we got the 5 at 5, abbreviated style. Let's do it.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, we'll start out with a little conference realignment news. The Mountain West, they got a big addition today. Well, I guess they retained UNLV and Air Force as they've committed to the Mountain West. Mountain West Commissioner Gloria Navarez, she has got 7 schools, the remaining 7 in the Mountain West, to commit and sign something, you know, that says they'll be in the Mountain West through 2032. So now both the Pac-12 and Mountain West have 7 football members. Mountain West, they're going to be paying UNLV and Air Force a lot of the cash money that they're getting from the fees and the everything else from the Mountain West schools leaving to go to the Pac-12. So it looks like the Pac-12 Mountain West not done yet, but they're still vying for that 8th football member, as need to have 8 members to be a conference.
And they're fighting over some of the same schools, so it'll be interesting to see who strikes first, who strikes next. Like that? Moving on.
Number 2.
Well, the Blazers season is actually upon us. It's going to be here pretty soon. And the Blazers have announced today that they will honor Blazer legend Bill Walton with a band on their jerseys throughout the entire 2024-25 season. All the Blazers jerseys will feature a uniquely Walton tie-dye band along the top of the left side with his 32 number in white on all of the jerseys. And then an organization will also host a special Bill Walton tribute night on March 9th when the Blazers take on the Pistons at the Moda Center. Luke Walton is an assistant coach on the Detroit Pistons as well. That night is going to feature special elements throughout the night to honor Walton and all his contributions to Rip City. And all fans in attendance will be encouraged to wear tie-dye on that game. They'll receive a special tie-dye headband as well. Walton, of course, passed away May 27th at the age of 71.
When did you figure out how to compete as a player, as an individual? And did you learn that from somebody, or was that in you from the beginning?
I learned it from my older brother, Bruce, who was, he's the perfect big brother today. And Bruce, you know, he's a year older than me in school, and we were teammates growing up. And, you know, he was Maurice Lucas before Maurice Lucas. But that was when we were in high school and beyond. And he went to UCLA, and he was an All-America football player, academic All-America. He went on to play for the Dallas Cowboys. But when we were really young, Bruce, he was a bully. And he used to just beat me up unmercifully, and he would steal all my food. And so I learned that the only way that I could do anything was if I had to scrap and I had to fight. And then I had this fantastic coach. When I was first getting started, 8 years old, his name was Rocky. And then my parents were incredible parents with no interest in sports. So I had this culture that the family and the home was nothing to do with sports. A remarkable coach, starting when I was 8 years old, an older brother who would just beat me up and make me fight for everything. Not that he was trying to teach me how to fight, but he was trying to just steal all my food all the time.
Bill Walton, man, loved having him on the show.
Any
over
excuse
the years.
To hear Bill Walton, man, it's so good.
I was going to play another flyby sounder, and I was like, nah.
Number 3.
Anytime I can get Bill Walton the 5 at 5, so you play some clips. It's just the best, man. Another NBA news, Derrick Rose. He has announced his retirement, former number one overall pick out of Memphis. Remember, he led Memphis to the national championship game against Kansas, where Mario Chalmers hit the shot to go to overtime. Rose averaged 17 points, 5 assists per game in his career. He also won Rookie of the Year and MVP at the age of 22. He's the youngest MVP ever in the NBA with being the MVP at 22. And I will always remember him, watching him in his prime in person. One of the craziest athletes I've ever seen. Like, he was just something different. Yeah. But Derrick Rose announced his retirement today.
Yeah, I think if you are a basketball fan, this registers to you because, you know, we saw the hope and the promise, the talent in Derrick Rose, the injuries. You know, to me, his legacy will be that he never fully realized the ceiling that he probably could have had, but he was a very relatable player in that way as well.
Number four.
Well, we like to talk about the boosters of all these schools with the NIL. Phil Knight with the Oregon Ducks. Well, Michigan may be getting a new one. Dave Portnoy, of the founder and owner of Barstool Sports, he said today on Pardon My Take that he is willing to buy Michigan a quarterback every single season, upwards of $3 million a year. Portnoy did graduate from the University of Michigan, so of course he has ties there to the University of Michigan. But he says that Michigan needs a quarterback, and he is willing to spend $3 million a year to get one. His net worth is reportedly in the neighborhood of $100 million. He also said that because it's an NIL deal, he'll have him be on like the Pardon My Take show for like one segment a week, and it's kind of like a little write-off for him. So Michigan may be getting their own Phil Knight here with Dave Portnoy.
Maybe the BFT radio show should be getting into the NIL space. I don't know. I guess we are in a weird way.
We kind of are. Know? I was going to say, yeah.
Jaden Robinson. Jamba. There you go.
Number five.
Well, and finally, it is Thursday night football. We have it here. 7:50 the game. Hang out after this show here. But Cowboys at the Giants. Cowboys 5.5-point favorites. Daniel Jones 1-12 all-time in primetime games. I hate it, but I like the Giants, but I've also been terrible this year. So who you got, John?
You like the Giants? I'll take the Cowboys.
I hate it.
No
I hate
offense,
that,
man.
No, I hate it, no and offense. I've been bad, so I'm just going to continue the bad streak.
You got to do the opposite, as they say. There you go.
Got to pull a George. What are we doing here?
Why do you like the Giants?
I feel like the Cowboys are no good. Like, the Cowboys stink, too. Both teams stink. Give me the points.
Thursday night, weird things happen. You
Giants at home.
All right, read me at johnconzano.com. Come back tomorrow for more. Bald-faced truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Oh, I thought you said five. I might have.
You threw me off. You know, I'm trying to think.
This is like me on Monday saying, enjoy Thursday night football.
Enjoy Monday night football tonight.
I only gave you 4 days' notice. All right, so enjoy the game tonight. I have the Cowboys. He has the Giants. We'll see what happens.